In December of 2023, the four women of Team Salty Science embarked on their journey to row across the Atlantic Ocean as part of the World's Toughest Row Challenge. The annual race attracts teams from across the globe, meeting together in the village of San Sebastian in La Gomera, Canary Islands. Their objective: to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a rowing boat to the island of Antigua while being completely self-sufficient. I first spoke with Chantal Bejean, Isabel Cote, Noel Helder, and Lauren Shea back in September of 2023 as they were preparing and training for the race. In April of 2024, with the race completed, I once again had the opportunity to speak with the team about their experiences and all the challenges they faced along the way. They shared their triumphs as well as their struggles as they raced across the Atlantic in order to raise money and awareness for ocean conservation. Catching up with Team Salty Science today on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. I'm very excited to welcome back on the show the remarkable and courageous women of Team Salty Science: Chantal Bejean, Noel Helder, Lauren Shea, and Isabel Cote. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Now, we last talked in September of 2023 as you were preparing for the World's Toughest Row, and I am happy to announce to my listeners, if they don't already know, that your team, Team Salty Science, finished first in the women's division and overall seventh out of 38 teams. So that means you beat a bunch of men too. That's pretty cool.
That's right.
I watched every day. I logged into the app and I was looking at the tracker, and I was so happy to see that every day when I'd open up the app and look. I'm like, yes, they're still in first place. So we're going to talk about everything you experienced during the race itself in just a minute. But first, I can't even imagine the emotions you must have had as you crossed that finish line, especially knowing that you were the number one women's team. So, Isabel, can you describe that experience?
Yeah, it was overwhelming to get close to shore and all of a sudden see the bright lights of the media boat and people shouting and the lights of people sort of looking at us. I mean, it was dark, so all we could see were, you know, lights of cell phones sort of waving and people cheering. And after 38 days of just seeing three other people on the boat, having all that commotion was really was overwhelming. And once we reached the dock, there seemed to be hundreds of people. I know there weren't hundreds, but it felt like there were hundreds of people there, including our families. And it was really emotional. It was a relief. I'm not gonna lie, but it was, you know, I think back on it and every so often I look at our finished video and it sort of feels like it wasn't really me that was there. I'm looking at these four people thinking, wow, they did really well. It's a blur looking back on it.
Yeah, you mentioned the relief. I can't even imagine what that was like, but just knowing the fatigue, the exhaustion, and all the mental struggles that must come along with it, it must have just been such an emotional roller coaster. And when you cross that line, just knowing what you've accomplished and how proud you must have felt.
Yeah, for sure. A huge sense of pride. And, you know, as a team, we, you know, we had talked a lot about what our goals were for the crossing and being safe and having as positive a crossing as we could in terms of our interactions with one another and supporting each other, ranked above going fast and winning. And so to have such a successful crossing and then on top of that to take the first place was amazing. But in terms of relief, you know, even if, you know, for somebody who likes spending a lot of time offshore, and I'm one of those people, I really enjoy, you know, being offshore for weeks at a time and what you see there and just the, you know, the simplicity of that. Well, sometimes it's a bit complex too. But even if you're the kind of person who enjoys being offshore, it's a dangerous place. And we saw some really difficult weather and we broke a lot of equipment. And so it did feel throughout the crossing like we were just a few steps away from potential disaster. And so, you know, for example, our autopilot, you know, was hanging on by a thread from just a few days in. And so it just, that was always a stress, you know, is it going to hold up? And if it doesn't, then how does that change our experience? And is this problem about to arise? And, you know, you're just a couple of nights before, I think it might've been the night before our arrival, we had a large shark ram our rudder repeatedly, which was on the one hand, super cool to see such a big shark. On the other hand, it looked like there was potential for massive disaster. Like, you know, the shark rams the rudder so hard that we start cracking the hull or something like that, right? So you're always thinking, okay, what could go wrong? And there was always a lot of things that were either going wrong or about to go wrong. So getting to the other side is just this massive relief in that sense. And also, you know, you mentioned that, I mean, certainly we played a little leapfrog with the other faster women's team, the team that ended up taking second. So there were a few times in the race where they're ahead of us and then we overtook them and they overtook us again. But it's in the last 10-ish days or so that we really got ahead and then never let go of that lead. And it did feel like, you know, by the time they were, say, 100 miles behind us or 40 miles behind us, like the lead, you know, the win was ours to take. Unless, you know, something would break that would really change our progress. So certainly get into Antigua finally, still in first place for women's and with the boat in a good way was amazing.
I was going to ask, as the race approached, as the beginning of the race approached, did you have any surprises or setbacks? But the shark hitting the rudder, I think, answers that question.
There were many more. Yeah, I mean, you said as the race approached, I mean, even before leaving the dock the last few days, we had a problem with the relay to the autopilot on deck, which didn't work. So we had to fix that. It turns out that we broke it 5 days in or something like that. Anyways, so we had that happen. We had for a good chunk of the race, we didn't have that relay. Our autopilot arms were a real difficulty. The weather was so intense this year. The waves were so big that it put a lot of strain on the autopilot arms. And they started coming apart in ways that we hadn't anticipated. And so keeping an eye on those was always very important. Our chart plotter wasn't working quite right. We couldn't just set a heading on the autopilot and be confident that the boat would go in that direction. The boat would sway 30 or 40 degrees on around that heading. So we had to be really active at keeping an eye on our direction and make sure that we compensated the other way when the autopilot wouldn't go in the right direction. We flooded the water maker compartment 5-ish days in. So we didn't have at that point a working electric water maker. And so we had to rely on making water with a manual water maker, which is a very, very slow way to make water and eats up at the time that you're resting. Luckily, we had all the spares to fix the water maker and Lauren took the lead on that. She spent about 4 days spending a few hours a day in the cabin rebuilding the water maker. And so we were able to get that back in line. But there were a lot of things like that. We broke an oar and also the outrigger plates, which are the metal plates that hold the oar lock out a few inches from the gunwale. And a big wave at night, 3 or 4 nights in maybe, that wave pinned our oars under the boat and bent this quarter-inch metal to the point where it was no longer usable. And we unfortunately didn't have spares of that. So just a few days in, we didn't have a working middle rowing station. And so that's another example of, you know, thinking, okay, we can work with that because there's still two working rowing stations. But if another one becomes unusable, that's starting to mean some real big problems for us.
So you mentioned the big wave that hit the boat and caused some damage. Lauren, were you at all ever afraid for your life during the trip?
I mean, I was never afraid for my life. I think that I was definitely afraid at different times. We often had a lot of anxiety moving into the night hours. During the day, in the beginning, at least for the first 10 days, you know, we had these really big seas from behind and they would sometimes come from the sides. And it was, during the day, you know, it felt like you could deal with it because you could see it coming. But at night, you were pretty much blind to all of the waves around you. And so you were just kind of, as the sun was setting, you were like, okay, what's going to happen tonight? And we had like three nights in a row, which were really challenging. You know, the first few days, everyone's like getting over seasickness. So, you know, that's like wearing everybody down. And then the waves just continued to build. And then we had, you know, these days where the waves just kept getting bigger and you weren't, you know, you knew it would probably stay similar through the night, but yeah, you could no longer see what was coming for you. And that was often the times when we would have these really big knockdowns from the waves. And so times that I was afraid, for example, would be I was often asleep in my cabin when these things happened. And you get woken up to this like big slam on the deck and you hear all this kind of chaos that's happening and you know that the boat's been thrown off course. So now we're no longer steering. You know, oars might be pinned under the boat. So it's just like a very intense, it feels like it's a very long period of time. You can't immediately open the cabin door because you need to make sure some of the water has drained out of the deck before you're opening the hatch and seeing if you can come out. And you're trying to regain control of the boat and steer it so that the waves are behind you, which is going to be the most stable. But you can't see anything. We left during a new moon. So we had, you know, it was very dark. And it was really hard to orient yourself and steer. And so it was just like these really intense periods where, you know, you're kind of recovering. It's been like a very traumatic knockdown. You're trying to recover from that and get the boat under control. And you're kind of worrying about, you know, are we going to be able to get the boat in the right direction again before another wave hits us on the side? So there's just like this really intense period. So I think those were definitely the scariest moments. But those were also times when I think that we all responded really well as a team. You couldn't really freeze. You just had to perform and do what was required. And those were the times when I think, you know, the four of us pulled together really well and just like we're making things happen quickly and managed to get the boat every time, you know, back under control. And fortunately, never had, you know, anything too severe happen. Yeah, we broke equipment, but the overall hull of the boat was always okay. We were really good about keeping the cabin doors closed in big seas. So we didn't have like, you know, full cabins flooding or anything like that. So I think we kind of came out of that period a little bit scarred from, you know, the things that happened to us. But we also came out of that pretty confident and like felt really good about the boat. We developed a lot of trust in her after that. And then it really felt like, okay, well, we went through a super tough time. Like we can, you know, we got this, we can tackle the rest of the challenges that happened. So yeah, it was a really steep learning curve in the beginning and definitely scary, but we, you know, we got through it.
You mentioned so many things there, all kinds of different challenges that you would have to face. And I imagine when you get rocked like that by a wave, your first reaction is just maybe probably a little disoriented and trying to figure out what the situation is. Noelle, when something like that happens, did you all have a specific job, or how did you communicate to each other what should happen in an emergency situation like that?
Yeah, we didn't have predetermined jobs for each of us, you know, when something happened, because it's just so context dependent on who's on deck at that time, who just came on, who's asleep in the cabin. There are certain jobs that are sort of assigned to you based on where you were at that given time. So for example, when we're knocked off course by one of these big waves, while Lauren was in the cabin for most of these, I was on deck for a lot of them. And so my rowing position was in the bow seat, which is the farthest from the steering system. So for example, when we had a big knockdown, whoever was on deck rowing in the stern position would be the person that would jump up and immediately be responsible for manning the lines and trying to get the boat turned around while the person in the cabin is getting woken up to adjust things like that. So there were some of those jobs that were fairly, you know, sort of self-sorted into what needed to happen at any given moment. But there are also plenty of times where I remember one big hit in particular that was extremely disorienting for me, and I think Chantal was on deck at the time. I just remember being a little bit rattled after it. Like, we took this big hit and you're really shaken. They're very violent hits. I don't know that I was prepared for that. You're kind of thrown to the side and everybody's all bruised up and whatnot, and it's really loud for those. Feels like a long time. In reality, it's just a few seconds, right? As you're kind of riding out this wave a little bit. And the first order of business was usually to make sure that the gunwales were clear. So you're basically swamped and there's a lot of water that comes over the deck of the boat when any of these waves, and you want to make sure that water's draining out. So first thing is kind of checking those, making sure there's not any trash or water jugs or anything that's blocking where the boat's going to drain, so that you know that water is going to move off the boat. And then beyond that, there was a lot of times of like, oh, are you okay? Like, check in with your teammates, try to make contact, verbal contact with whoever's in the cabins, because while being on deck is, of course, scary in those hits, if you're asleep and just get thrown into the wall of the cabin or knocked around, that's also a tough place to be in. Water would also, and I shared the bow cabin, and we, whenever we would get swamped like that, lots of water would also pour in through the vent. So the person who's in the bow cabin is now going for a little bit of a midnight swim with a couple inches of water soaking their mattress. So lots of verbal communications to check in. And one thing that we also did especially on these few nights when there were lots of sleep interruptions and lots of times when people in the cabins had to get called on deck to help stabilize whatever was happening, where we ended up sleeping in our foul weather gear and in your harness, so that as soon as something happened, you were ready to come out on deck and help, as instead of taking even the few extra seconds or even a minute or so to kind of gear yourself back up. We were always ready to go and jump into action as soon as it happened.
Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. The weather, obviously, is going to be a significant factor at times. Now, that time of the year is not as bad as later, but did you encounter some pretty severe storms there?
no storms really, other than the really wild weather in the first 10 days. So we knew the race started when there was a 2-day-ish window of relatively calm weather just out of La Gomera. But we knew that we were going to hit something right after that. Everybody could see that on the weather patterns. But after that, it was just unusual. I guess every year probably is unusual, but this one was more unusual than most. In that, after the that 8 to 10 day period of really wild, disorganized seas, we had a couple of good days, and then we had what we called the cement days, where we were hoping to catch the trade winds that would blow us towards the west, and but the wind just died, or if anything, blew slightly against us, and the waves just died, and we were in this flat sea, having to have two people essentially power this one-ton boat through the wave, and it just felt literally like we were rowing in wet cement. It was just so heavy, and it was so disheartening as well, because we made, in the rough weather, I mean, it was definitely scary at times, but we made incredible mileage. One day we covered 95 nautical miles, which I think was the fastest boat that day. And then we went to barely covering one knot in a, you know, a nautical mile an hour in a 24-hour period. So you go from nearly 100 to barely 24. And so that was, you know, you keep telling yourself you're still making forward progress, but that was really disheartening. But once the cement days were over, then it was a bit better. We did good mileage. We had wind that was never truly easterly. It was sort of northeasterly or southeasterly. So none of us really believe that trade winds exist at this point.
Earlier, Lauren had mentioned various things that happened at different times and different people were on the deck. Chantal, can you describe how you worked out those shifts of who would be eating or who would be rowing? How did that all work out?
Yeah, we did something a bit different than most teams, and it worked really well for us. So a lot of teams of four switch off every 2 hours. So they row for 2 hours, and then they do everything else, and the other, you know, they rest from rowing in the other 2 hours, which means sleeping, eating, you know, getting cleaned up, making water, all of the things that need to happen. And we followed that rotation in the daytime, so for the 12 hours of sunlight. And at night, we switched to 3 on, 3 off, so that we would, of course, that means that you have to row for 3 hours, which is quite difficult physically to power through that. It's also difficult to stay awake for 3 hours in the middle of the night. But on the flip side of that, it meant that we could sleep for almost 3 hours at a time. I mean, really 2.5 hours when it's all said and done. And sleeping for 2.5 hours at a time was infinitely better to us than sleeping an hour and a half at a time. That is just such a short period of time. And so we immediately tried that watch pattern, and we really liked it. And the other thing that we did that I found really positive, I think the whole team agrees on that, is that we offset when we would switch off. So Isabel and Noelle shared the bow cabin. Lauren and I shared the stern cabin. And so we would never row with our roommate. So that, you know, once I was rowing, then, you know, Lauren would have the cabin to herself to rest. But what we did is, if Isabel and Noel would switch off on the even hours, on the 12s and 2s and 4s, Lauren and I would switch at the 1s and 3s and 5s, so that, you know, I would go on there for my rowing shift. I would row with Isabel for an hour, and then she would go rest, and then Noel would come up. And that was really nice, because it meant that you interacted with more people. And so it was kind of fun. I had different podcasts with Isabel and different kinds of music than I did with Noah. I had a book that I would look forward to listening to with Noah. And then I had these podcasts that I'd continue on with Isabel. So it's kind of a different dynamic. It also means that in that 2 hours or 3 hours, you have something kind of breaking it up in between. And mentally, at least for me, that was huge. It just kind of changes things up a little bit. You know, I only need to make it to this midway mark before something happens. And also, you know, if you're really tired, you know, having somebody come in halfway through kind of brings in some fresh energy. And it also makes it a bit easier to switch off without losing speed. If, you know, the two rowing stations are switching off essentially at the same time, it's a bit of a dance of like, you guys go first and then we'll go, or everybody stops and then the boat really slows down. And then it's really hard to, you know, regain that speed. So having that offset switch in wash teams was really nice. Hmm.
I was wondering about that and whether or not you would overlap your shift. So most importantly, you mentioned, I think it really helps keep that teamwork, keep everybody cohesive, because you're seeing everybody every few hours. You get to talk to everybody equally. I think that's important on such a intimate trip like this, when you're all in such a confined space doing such difficult work.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it can be hard to link up with people, right? Because oftentimes when you're off, you're so tired, certainly at night, we were so tired, we'd go immediately to sleep. But oftentimes it was too hot on deck, so we'd go in the cabins. Or for me, for a while, I just couldn't sit anymore. I had too much sitting. My bum was hurting really bad. And so in my off shifts I feel like I had a couple weeks where I just had to retreat to my cabin to lay down just to get off my bum. And so that really limits how you interact with other people. And so that really helped. And of course, we never rode with our roommate, but you'd see your roommate as you switch off with them. And we also had little whiteboards in the cabins and would leave little messages to our roommate. And that was kind of fun.
That's great. I want to jump back to the beginning of the race, or even the preparation right before the race, after you're already in the Canary Islands. Did you get to know any of the other people and the other teams?
We got to know a few teams. It was definitely wild, like showing up in La Gomera and seeing like the boatyard full of, you know, 38 other boats and teams that have been having like a mirrored experience to what we, you know, have been going through for the past 3 years. In your immediate circle at home, you know, you're the only person doing this like thing. But then all of a sudden you're surrounded by a bunch of people who have been also doing, you know, preparing for their trip. And that was really cool to see all these people and all be in the same place for those 2 weeks. And people really helped each other. There are people, you know, who had extra gear and then people that needed gear. And so things were always swapping around. People were always looking at, you know, ways that most of the boats are made by the same builder, but they're from different, you know, different building years. People like outfit them differently. So you're kind of checking that out. So all of us, you know, we all had different problems for those 2 weeks and we're kind of all trying to help each other. Lots of different things happen to different teams. Lots of, you know, equipment breaking. Some boats got damaged during shipping, but then we all managed to pull it together and all be ready for a December 13th departure. We were also like really on edge. We had the weather kept changing and our start date kept changing, which was pretty stressful for our team, as well as many other teams who, you know, were discovering different things that were failing on their boat. So, you know, finally being told what the day was and being ready for that, I think was a huge relief. But also now you're like, okay, now I have, you know, now we have to go and do this thing. Like, that's pretty, you know, pretty scary.
If I can add the element of prepping with all of these boats together and doing this as a race. I mean, some people were extremely social in La Gomera and got to know everybody and were out every night grabbing dinner with different teams. We were very focused on preparing. So we were very focused on our own team. And then once our family members came in the last week, we also spent time with them. So we didn't get to know everybody very well, but there was a handful of teams that we got to know a little bit better. And it was really cool as we were crossing to get reports from our shore-based team as to where these other teams were. And then once we finished, to follow these various teams of the people that we had gotten to know a little bit better, including the Intrepid team, who ended up having a world record for the oldest women's team to ever finish. And they had a really crazy difficult approach to Antigua with insane weather at the end. And, you know, Ocean Grown and Liz, who they both set new records for women's pairs and solos. And it was so fun to cheer on those teams after you had met them in La Gomera. So for me, that was like a very cool aspect of doing this as part of a race.
What was it like as the race was starting? Was it hectic? You know, Lauren, what was that experience like?
So we all, you know, we all start like staggered. So the teams with the most amount of teammates, so the biggest team was five, all the way down to solos with one person. So we start from, you know, the biggest team to the smallest team. And in the beginning, we're kind of, because you're staggered, you're pretty spread out, even when you're leaving the harbor. And I think we lost sight of definitely every boat by the next morning. We only had like a few boats, like navigation lights that we could see that first night. But after that first night, we did not see anyone. The boat that we were kind of like neck and neck with for a lot of the race, we saw them on our AIS a few times. So they're like satellite signal. And we also saw their nav lights one night when we were like 1 mile away from them. And but after that, the next time we saw another rowing boat was actually the final day. So our arrival day, we kind of maybe spotted the boat, a boat that was right in front of us, like basically a mile away from us for the whole final 24-hour approach. But for the rest of the time, you're offshore, don't see any other rowboats for sure. We saw some ships, which is always like kind of exciting. But besides that, you know, not much, just us and our boat and any wildlife that comes to visit.
Just alone in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, no big deal, right?
Yeah.
On the app that I was looking at the whole time during the race, sometimes it looked like you're very close together, but obviously the scale has a lot to do with that. So that was really fun to watch on the tracker, actually. And at some point, some of the, especially at the beginning, there were boats pointing all over the place in different directions. It just gave me a chuckle when I saw that.
Yeah, what you were looking at often when these boats were in different directions is really unfavorable weather, where they had to be on pair anchor for some period of time. And so they'd just be drifting and then their bow is in the wrong direction. And so it's really, you're not the only person who got kind of addicted with the app. My whole neighborhood here was refreshing the app constantly, but it's really hard to tell what's going on. You see the boats going all in the same direction at pretty good speed, and all of a sudden they're all going in circles. So it's really hard to figure out unless you're really keeping an eye on weather.
Now, unfortunately, there was some sad news that came out of the race in that one of the other team captains from Old Aussie Salts, Alistair Putt, died of a heart attack on January 4th. Given the situation, when were you made aware of his death?
Yeah, so we learned about Alistair and the Aussie Old Salts. I guess the day, I don't remember the exact day, but it was the same day that they announced it publicly, that the race let everyone know. And yeah, that was a really terrible phone call to get. I think Lauren was the one who received the sat phone message and had to relay that to us. And it's just an absolute tragedy. And we were so devastated to hear that news and to just imagine what the rest of the team was also then experiencing. And they were able to get rescued and picked up by a ship that was taking them to Norway. So we're really grateful for the rest of the team's safety in that. But when speaking about people that we were able to interact with in La Gomera, the Aussie Olds. So when SAR boats were launched in the water and in the marina for those couple of days, you're kind of rafted up to two other boats. And so we were in between two teams, and one of those was the Aussie Old Salts. And so we stepped over their boat every day and chatted and laughed with them at the starting line. So which was just really fun. And, you know, I think Alistair might have been one of the last people we spoke with before we actually pushed off. So it was absolutely devastating to hear. And, you know, our thoughts go out to Alistair's family and friends and everyone who knew and loved him. But I think that one piece that sort of gave us a little bit of, I don't know what the right word is, but it wasn't necessarily race related. You know, it wasn't caused by, you know, a team made a mistake or had an experience that resulted in his death. And I think we tried to take a little bit of solace from that. So obviously that's tough news to receive when you're kind of the farthest from shore at that moment that you're going to get in that crossing. So yeah, I'm not sure if anyone else has anything else to add, but our thoughts are definitely with all members of the Aussie Old Salts team, and incredibly grateful for the incredible boat that was able to pick them up safely and get them home.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research about him just to remember him and honor him, but he was an ex-spy and a war crimes investigator in Australia, quite a life. So my sincere sympathies go out to his family for sure.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors and eventually right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
I have a question that I'd like all of you to answer in turn, if you don't mind. We've mentioned already many of the hardships and challenges, but for each of you individually, what was the most difficult part of this race? Isabel, we'll start with you.
Oh, gosh. I think the first 10 days, I was absolutely terrified. I actually really thought I was going to die when night after night, the boat would get hit and something would break. And at that point, hadn't really developed much trust in the boat and hadn't realized how difficult that boat would be to capsize. And I, having essentially no offshore experience, there's nothing in our training that had really prepared me for the conditions that we experienced. So the only thing I'm grateful for actually is that those days came early in the trip rather than in the middle or at the end, because everything after that just seemed easy. But yeah, that was to me, that was absolutely terrifying, and I just couldn't believe I had put myself in that position. I was really reevaluating my life choices at that point.
Chantal?
Yeah, I feel like the weather early on, certainly, it was really challenging. It was really scary. I had this weird sort of recurring dream when I did manage to dream in my short sleeps. And I kept dreaming that we were on the dock in the Canary Islands getting ready. And then I would wake up and go, oh, no, we're here. Oh, I have to go on deck in this. And that was tough. I think the difficult part for me in that, after a few days of this really intense weather, after a few really big waves crashed on top of the boat, and the boat was fine, and we got to learn how to, you know, if we slow down so much that the autopilot would quit working, oftentimes we need it, you know, to certainly have two people rowing while the other person steered and then the fourth person hooked the autopilot back up. We learned that, and we just kind of learned that dance. And so for me, after a few days, I feel like I trusted the boat. The difficult mental part was, okay, you know, can we get through this without so many breaks that it becomes real problematic? And we had done a really good job of packing the spares and the equipment that we needed. But for example, I had never considered that the outrigger plates could bend. We had multiple oars. We had multiple oar locks. We had multiples of all of these things that seemed like they would fail. But these big metal plates, I had no idea. And it turns out it's not that often that they bend, but it's also not that crazy that it happened. And so thinking early on when we knew we had many days still of this really intense weather, thinking, okay, can the boat hold up in terms of, you know, not breaking so much? That was a tough one. And in that time, just the wetness was terrible. You could never get dry. We'd be on deck and, you know, be surfing down a wave. So, you know, our feet are higher than the rest of our body and you take a big wave. It turns out your foul weather gear doesn't protect you that well when the water can just, you know, slide down from the ankles, you know, up your body because your body is in that position. So we're soaking wet because of that. And then we'd get into the cabins and make the cabins wet because our foul weather gear would just drip. You step onto your bed. And of course in the bow cabin, on top of that also had a bunch of water come in the vent and there's no way around that. And so this is as we're starting to get really sore bums and rashes because we're always wet and we're always rubbing and there's just sort of no way to dry up and get comfortable in that. I mean, our mattresses were completely soaked. It was right around Christmas. I think it was Christmas Day that finally was calm enough that we could get the mattresses out on deck to start drying them up a little bit. And the one from our cabin was moldy. There was just visible mold everywhere on it. So that was a real struggle. And at the end of the day, it's just your reality. And so while I highlight this as just one of the hardest things, it's also like you sign up for this. It's a tiny, tiny boat. And so, you know, that was a known thing that was going to happen. But the reality of it was pretty hard.
I think, all of us will refer to like the first 10 days as just like pretty scary and big and intense. And similar to what Chantal was saying, like the rate at which we were breaking things was kind of scary. It was pretty scary when our water maker broke really early on. I definitely was like pretty stressed about, you know, like what if we can't fix it? What if it breaks again? And like we've used all of our spares and that's it. Like this is our second chance. And I mean, we had emergency water jugs that would, you know, buy us some time. We had a manual water maker, but the crossing just would have been very different if we didn't have an electrical water maker and had to pump it all ourselves. And the fatigue that would have come along with that, that was definitely very stressful. So that was pretty hard. I would also say that coming out of that, it was also really hard for me during those days when we were upwind. I remember the forecast kept changing. And I just remember one day Chantal coming out and telling us like the most recent weather forecast and that like we were going to be in this for another 2 days. And I just couldn't believe it. I was just so mad. Which, like, obviously you can't do anything about it and really doesn't matter how you feel about it. This is the reality and you need to, like, just deal with it, which once I came around, it was fine. But, I think it was just like, oh, my gosh, we have to keep – this is so hard. And I developed, like, a shoulder issue in not – I don't know if it was an injury, but just, like, a lot of shoulder pain during that time. And then you kind of start to question like, oh man, is this going to get worse? Am I going to have to stop rowing? I don't want to let my teammates down. So I think it's just the scale of the trip is like pretty difficult to wrap your head around. I mean, we finished a lot faster than we had, you know, left the dock thinking it would take us. You know, we were planning for 45 to 50 days offshore. We had enough food for 55 days. So finishing in, but like, of course, you just, you have no idea, even when, you know, you're a week, you think you're maybe a week's distance from Antigua, like so many things could happen, you know, like Chantal mentioned, the team Intrepid, you know, they got caught in a weather system when they were really close to Antigua and, you know, they were stuck for another 10 days trying to get in. So you just really don't know what's going to happen. I think that scale of the trip can really start to wear on you if you kind of let it get out of control in your mind. And I really had to remind myself every single shift, like, okay, control the controllables, like the, you know, all the rest you just have to deal with. Control what you can and you know, just try to, and yeah, I think having a supportive team around you and making the most out of each day really helps you kind of through that.
Noelle?
I think that what all of my teammates have said were all difficult components for sure. And I share those feelings. And, you know, we've all talked about this quite a lot. So I guess I was going to say the slow period was tough, but Lawrence took that one. So, but yeah, I guess just one of the difficult things for me, in addition to what everyone else has spoken about, is the rowing into the headwind became not only physically very difficult, like it was exhausting rowing in those conditions day after day. And we was also starting to get hotter outside. So 2-hour shifts, feeling like you're rowing through cement was physically tough. And that is when everyone started to feel different aches and pains. Lauren had a shoulder injury that she mentioned pop up. And all of us sort of had different pieces of after rowing like that for 2 hours, something was feeling a little bit off, or we had to swap out the different cushions that we were sitting on for a change, essentially. But I just remember, I think this was the day we did 24 miles. And I remember going in the cabin and calculating how many days it would take us to get to Antigua at that rate if we continued going at 24. And it was something ridiculous, like 65 days from that point or something, which obviously wasn't going to happen. But that was a mentally challenging time to push through. You knew it would end, but it also felt like every day you woke up and we'd get a new weather report that pushed the end date a day or two out. And it was tricky because you wanted to anticipate it being over, but you also, you know, have to stay so present and focused. It's easy to get discouraged if you're constantly thinking tomorrow it's going to be different or tomorrow it's going to be better. It was a really great reminder to just be present and respond to the conditions that you had, and that's what you're going to get. And there's nothing you can do about it. Like Lauren says, control the controllables. And I think it was a tough time to come in the wake of the huge, scary conditions. And also felt like you couldn't really complain because we'd just been complaining about being afraid in these big waves. And then we kind of swung to the opposite end of the spectrum and had these completely opposite conditions. So a little bit of whiplash back and forth with the conditions that was challenging to figure out how to react.
Now, the goal of Team Salty Science was not just to row across the Atlantic, you know, just that minor task, but to raise money to support marine conservation education. And by the way, Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs was a mile sponsor for you, proud to support. You are all marine scientists and educators, and obviously passionate about the health of our oceans. What organizations are going to benefit from the work that you did with Salty Science?
So the one that I'm particularly close to is the Canadian-based organization, which is actually a field station. It's called the Banfield Marine Science Center. And it's a center on the west coast of Vancouver Island in an area that's incredibly pristine. And it offers incredible facilities to do marine research, but also to attend a variety of courses and have field experiences that range from, you know, first grade kids all the way to graduate students. And the experiences that students get from attending anything at Banfield is truly life-changing. And so many people that I know have been turned on to marine sciences and have gone into marine research and done graduate degrees or are now working in various positions as in government or in consultancies. And that interest really was triggered by the Banfield Marine Science Center. So some of the money that we've raised is going to go towards establishing a scholarship that's going to help particularly underrepresented groups to attend the Banfield Marine Science Center, basically lowering the financial cost barrier that prevents so many people from attending facilities like that.
Another charity that we're supporting is one that I started along with my husband, another co-founder, that's called Shellback Expeditions. And we work in mostly in the Eastern Caribbean. And the purpose of Shellback is to help collect data on coastal ecosystems, to help local communities use these data for evidence-based management of their resources. And so this is a region in the Caribbean, with small island developing states and limited capacity, very small governments, limited funding for that kind of research. And there's also no big research stations that attract scientists from other places, well, at least in the volcanic arc of the Eastern Caribbean. I've worked in that area for many years and regularly take students from Florida to field courses in that area. And one of the cool things that I can do with Shellback is then support the cost of research and monitoring that can happen alongside these field courses.
And then our third organization is an organization called GreenWave, which is based in the northeast of the U.S. And GreenWave does a lot of ocean farming, specifically for kelp, but they also do some shellfish farming as well, growing, you know, organisms together in a 3D farm. And they provide, they have their own farm, own kelp farm, but they also train lots of other kelp farmers now spread across the world and provide a lot of support for those farmers who want to start up their own kelp farm where they live.
Well, thankfully, your trip and everything was very successful, and these organizations can continue to do their work and hopefully save our oceans. Well, Noel, before I let all of you go, was there anyone that you would like to thank from behind the scenes who was supportive of your efforts?
So many people to thank. We were the ones rowing, but there was a whole team of humans around North America, really, that were supporting us throughout. I guess a couple people in particular, our coach, Katie Hart, was amazing. We couldn't have done this without her. She made sure that we were in tip-top condition to row, not only fast, but most importantly, safely and efficiently. Of course, we want to thank Chantal's husband, Boomer, who was really important for weather routing, as well as Lauren's fiance, Tim. They were really the shore team that we were in contact with most frequently, getting updates and they were the ones that were telling us, you know, which days we might expect the conditions to shift. And so they were really, really critical in sending us news from shore. All of our families have been really supportive and incredibly important in this expedition. It's not easy to give so much of our time to something like this at the expense of our families. So they were all been amazing. Many different communities, Chantal's community and neighborhood in particular in Arizona, that's where our boat was based and a lot of our training happened. So we had friends really step up in really incredible ways to support us, as well as, of course, our many, many wonderful financial and gear sponsors, including everyone who sponsored a mile, including this podcast. We're so grateful for all of you. We absolutely couldn't have done it without you.
But I will add that one cool aspect that Noelle ties into this is she's coming to the Grenadines with me in June. So I'm taking a field course, of USF students to the Grenadines. We're doing our teaching and, you know, regular thing. And Noelle has this expertise in coral photogrammetry. So she knows how to set things up to take a bunch of overlapping photos of the reef with spatial markers so that from there you can create 3D models of the reef that can be used later on for all kinds of purposes in research and monitoring. And so that is supported by Shellback. And that's one of the things that I want to keep going in the next few years. I'm super stoked that Noelle can be a part of that and help teach me how to do that.
Well, thank you again, Salty Science. The four of you are really an inspiration to what somebody can achieve just through determination and courage and hard work. So I, for one, am really impressed and inspired. So thank you so much for joining me here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Rich.
Yeah, thank you.
That will do it for this episode, Catching Up with Team Salty Science. Thank you so much for listening. A huge thank you to Chantal, Lauren, Isabel, and Noelle for taking the time to speak with me again. They're doing such outstanding work in their respective fields of marine sciences, and you can learn more about them and their work at saltyscience.org. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can help support the show by making a donation at buymeacoffee.com/shipwreckspod, or by subscribing to the Into History podcast channel at intohistory.com/shipwreckspod. Subscribers get ad-free listening, bonus content, and early access to this and many other fantastic history podcasts. Also, please consider leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs on social media at ShipwrecksPod or on the web at shipwrecksandseadogs.com. Original theme music is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him at seansiegfried.com or on YouTube at SeanSecret. Please join me again next time. But until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.